Frank Lloyd Wright was one of America's great architects. He was born 2 years after the Civil War and died the year before John F. Kennedy was elected president, so he lived through some interesting eras. But he had an eye for building and design that made him very, very famous. He built a number of things up Chicago area. Dr. Rinker knows about him, probably Dr. Reinhardt, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania. Skyscrapers to personal homes. He designed, including the one that's on the screen, Falling Water House in Pennsylvania. He had an ability to design things that fit the environment and blend it in. And so a number of his buildings now are museums, like this one, where you can go and pay to go through it. They're so fascinating. But there was an incident in his life that at the time didn't seem very significant, but would have a profound effect on him. It was the winter that he was 9 years old. And he was walking in a field with his uncle, very serious, sober-minded, no-nonsense uncle. And they walked across the snow-covered field, got to the other end, and the uncle turned around and pointed at their tracks. And his tracks were straight like an arrow's flight. And little Frank's meandered all over the place. And he said, "Frank, look at this." He said, "My tracks went directly to my goal. Your tracks went all over. You were at the fence, to the cows, to the woods, and back again. They wandered everywhere." He said, "There's an important lesson to be learned here." Years later, when recalling that, Frank Lloyd Wright would say, it had a great, profound impact on his philosophy of life. He said, "That day, I made a decision that from then on, I would not miss out on most things in life as my uncle had." And that's how he lived his life, always looking and seeing things others couldn't see. My concern is that we are missing out on a lot of things in life. Things that, because of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, are available to us and we are not experiencing. I was reading in the pastoral epistles in 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus in the Greek New Testament, and I kept running across a particular word. I want you to turn to 1 Timothy chapter 1. Our text eventually will be in Colossians 3. But as I'm reading through the pastorals, notice, if you will, starting in verse 8, the text says, "We know that the law is good if a man use it lawfully, knowing this, that the law is not made for a righteous man, but for the lawless and the disobedient." And he's now going to go into a list of very bad behavior, bad people. Notice his list. The law is made for the lawless, the disobedient, for the ungodly, for sinners, for unholy and profane, for murderers of fathers and murderers of mothers, manslayers, whoremongers, for them that defile themselves with mankind, men stealers, liars, perjured persons, and if there be any other thing contrary to sound doctrine." Wow, this is a bad list. And in this list, there was a particular word that I found unusual, and it caught my eye, and it's the word profane. And I thought, profane. When I think of profane, I think of, you know, maybe bad speech, profanity. But I wondered, what is this word? And I began to look at it, and the origin of it has the idea with just ground that you walk on. In fact, one of the cognates in the family of this with this word is the word for threshold. Just something you walk across. Just ground that anybody can walk on. And in fact, in the theological lexicon, when it talks about this word, one of them described it as that which is accessible to everybody, the opposite of inaccessible or sacred. So, you know, the basic idea of the word is it's something for everybody. It's something common that everybody uses. But eventually it came to have the idea of taking something that shouldn't be common, that should be sacred, and making it common. In fact, the verb form is used in Matthew to talk about profaning the temple, and in Acts about profaning the Sabbath. Here in this text is talking about a person. This word's used as an adjective just five times in the New Testament, four of them in the pastorals. And then once in Hebrews when it refers to Esau, who was a profane man, it says. So when it talks about a person being common, what does that mean? And what's the idea of profaning the Sabbath or a temple? And again, it means you take something that ought to be very special and you make it common. And apparently, that can refer to people. People like Esau and like the person here in our list should have been special, and instead they were common, profane. Literally, they were just like everybody else is the idea. They were just human. In fact, the word came to take on that idea. Those of you that study Greek, your favorite lexicon, the big one, we call it BDAG, Bauer, Dankert, and Gingrich, it defines this word this way. You might think when we translate it profane, it's going to have some idea of something bad, but it simply means pertains to being generally public, pertains to being accessible to everyone, and therefore devoid of real significance, pointless, worthless. But then when it became applied to people, it talked about persons who are being worldly as opposed to having an interest in the transcendent matters, totally worldly. So, what's so bad about this characteristic? Why is it in this list with these horrible descriptions of behavior? What's wrong with just being ordinary, human, average, common? And the idea is, you don't have to be. You can be something more. You can be something very special. You could live a life tapped into the spiritual, but you're only living in the flesh. You could live a life that is accessible to another world, but you're living only in this world. You are only human. And they describe that as being profane. Paul picked up on this idea in 1 Corinthians 3. He was talking to the people at Corinth, Christians, who were very carnal. And in describing them, he says of them, "You are yet carnal. There is among you envying, strife, divisions. Are you not carnal?" And then he says, "And walk as men." The word for men translated there, again, my Greek students will know. Anthropos, anthropology, you understand that word. It's a word for men, but it can also just mean humankind, humans. And literally, Paul is saying, you're carnal. You're acting like humans. You get the idea. We're not supposed to be just human. There's something more, something else we can have. If we are just common, just human, we are profane. And God wants us to have something much more. For believers, to be merely human is a disaster. So I want to talk to you about four things. And the first point I want to make is this. What's so bad about being merely human? Well, of course, the problem is being merely human is that our humanness has been corrupted, right? And we know that since the fall, being human isn't so great. We, in fact, have in Genesis 6 a description of humanity that's about as bad as it ever got, where every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually, where the earth was filled with violence. And it's as if God allowed humanity and its fallenness, its corruptness, to degenerate to a point he eventually wiped out the earth. And he made a hint back there that his spirit would not always strive with man, implying that his spirit does strive with man to hold back maybe the impulses of evil. We know that from the New Testament. God's spirit is convicting the world of sin and righteousness and judgment. The Bible says there is that which restrains, and someday it'll be taken out of the way, and when that happens, the man of sin will be revealed. So there are these restraining spiritual forces, thank God, that are on this earth hindering our fallen humanity from being as bad as it could be. And so here we see humanity has been corrupted. How many things in our existence we deal with just because of sin? I was thinking of my keys. All these keys. You know why we have keys? Sin, right? Would we need them without sin? These poor maintenance guys, wow, you know, burdened down with sin, you know. Dress codes. Do you realize we wouldn't need a dress code? Do you realize we wouldn't need clothes if it wasn't for sin, right? How many things in our existence we have to manage just to manage sin and sinfulness? This human condition we're in is not so great. Being just human isn't all it's cracked up to be. And our human condition has been corrupted. It takes a lot of time to manage sin. A father was teaching his child about time, his little toddler. If you want to manage sin, just manage toddlers. He was teaching his toddler about time, and he heard his son was in the kitchen. He was out sitting in his chair in the front room, and so he thought, oh, I'll take this opportunity. And so he yells into the kitchen to his little toddler son. He said, son, he said, what's the big hand on? Because that's how he was teaching him time, you know, big hand, little hand thing. Son, what's the big hand on? And a guilty little voice called back, a cookie. By the way, little toddlers grow up and go to college. There was a college, this is a true story, and they had their lunch line was a smorgasbord buffet thing, only in that college you took one offering of everything you got. One of the things you go through the line. And so students were doing a little more than that. And there was a sign as they started in the line over the fruit, over the apples. One apple. God is watching you. And at the end of the line, at the dessert, there was some cookies, and there was a quickly hand-scribbled sign by the cookies that said, take all the cookies you want to eat. God's watching the apples. It's bad theology, but it's an important lesson. We all got our hands on the cookies. We are all sinful and corrupted in our sinfulness. We are slaves to sin and we cannot please God. Romans 8 says, the carnal mind is enmity against God. It is not subject to the law of God. Neither indeed can be. It won't submit to God. And the truth is it can't submit to God. That's us in our humanness. That's the norm. That's the ordinary of humanity. Unsaved can only be fleshly, carnal, worldly. Nothing special. But something happened, point number two, to change this situation, and it's the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And because of that, our horrible condition is transformed. It's changed. And so I want you now to go to Colossians chapter 3, our text. The resurrection of Jesus Christ was an earthquake in the universe of man, of humanity. And it's never recovered. It became the dividing line in humanity. It became the entry point to a relationship with God. Something wonderful. Something beyond their experience as mere humans now is available to them because of the resurrected Christ. And notice here, starting in verse 1, Paul is going to set the stage. He's going to talk about the effect of the resurrection on you as a human being. He says in verse 1, if ye then be risen with Christ, seek those things that are above, where Christ sitteth on the right hand of God. Set your affection on things above, not on things of the earth, for you are dead and your life is hid with Christ in God. And so the resurrection of Christ is talked about here. If you then be risen with Christ, he is risen. He is ascended. He is on the right hand of God. It's described here as being above. There is something outside of the world, outside of humanity's only existence that it knows. There's something else, and it's above. And he says, if you are risen with him, you can experience something up there. And so, yes, we know Christ is risen, but you also are risen with him. You see, the resurrected Christ lives in another reality beyond this earth. He sits above on the right hand of God. He said while he was on the earth, I am not from this world. I go to the Father. And now we can have that accessible to us. This heavenly existence, this spiritual existence. None of that was available to us in our humanness before, in our fallenness before. But now, because of the resurrection of Christ, human beings can have a relationship, an experience in something that's heavenly, that is of the new creation, that is spiritual, not just of the flesh. And so united with him, that's our new reality. And now I am anything but ordinary. I am God's temple, his dwelling place. I am God's child through new birth and adoption. I am God's heir, a joint heir with Jesus Christ. I am God's vineyard. I am God's friend. I am God's co-worker. I am God's lover. He says in John 17 that he loves me with the exact same love that he loves his son, Jesus Christ. That's an amazing verse, verse 23. I am God's bride. I am his new creation. I am his vessel. I am his workmanship, his handiwork. Ephesians 2:10, for we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus. That word workmanship, I was sitting in Greek class as a student when I was your age, and I read the word, and it's the word poema. I am God's poem. And sitting there in Greek class, I wrote, I am God's poem. By him I am wrought, or each word in line he pondered and thought till that which he framed was just what he sought. Yes, I am God's poem, and praise him I ought. I am, and you are God's handiwork. You are special. You are not ordinary. And so point number three, we are now capable of living in another reality. Are you beginning to get the idea of how profane is so bad? Common, ordinary? There's something more available to you. And so look at Colossians 3. He said, if you are risen with Christ, seek those things that are above. Set your affection on things above. You see, we don't have time to go into explaining that in this sermon. Those are other sermons. But you get the idea. There's something available to us that we're to grasp. We're to have. We're to seek it. Long for it. Set our affection on it. Not miss out on it. And my concern is so many Christians are missing out on this reality. They are just living as humans. There's something more. I'm going to throw up a picture. It's one of my favorite pictures because it's my grandson. This is little 3-year-old Colt, lives in Seattle. I want to explain this picture. Little Colt's a very active boy. And sitting down and reading a book was not on his agenda. But last summer when I was with Gospel Heralds traveling, my wife went out to Seattle, spent some time out there, and she was able to finally pull out some books, and he sat down, and she was able to read to him. And in fact, he enjoyed it so much, she came home almost hoarse. For just hours, it seemed like she would read and read and read to him. So now it became their special thing. And when we're together, he just loves to crawl up on her lap. We were out there in March at spring break, and he just crawls up in her lap when he sees Gaga, is what he calls her, Gaga Linda, and has her read him a story. This picture's from just a couple of weeks ago. They were FaceTiming us. It was evening here 3 hours earlier. It was afternoon there, and he had just gotten up from his nap. Comes down the stairs, and he was out of sorts, as sometimes kids can be when they wake up. He was just having a fit, and he's a very good, disciplined boys, so it's, you know, unusual. And they were trying to calm him down, and they then said, you know, come say hi to Gaga. She's FaceTiming. And then my wife offered to tell him a story. And here's the result. He came over and began to look at the screen as she told him a story. They laid him down on the floor and put the phone in front of him. And he's right there looking at my wife, listening to Gaga tell him a story. Calmed him down. He was great after that. And you can just see on his face how much he loves listening to Gaga tell a story. Now, Gaga's not there. They're apart. They're distant. But you can see him experiencing it almost as if she was there, right? I'm not with Jesus. I'm not where he is. He's above. But I am to set my affection there, as if I'm there. I am to seek the things that are above, as if they're mine. What are the things above? Well, it's that perfect existence where Jesus is. What's it like up there? Perfect paradise, he described it to the thief on the cross. Perfect love. Perfect joy. Perfect peace. And he sits on the right hand of God, perfect power available to me. As I seek to tap into this other reality that is now mine, it's available to me. In fact, Ephesians says, I am actually seated in the heavens with Christ. What does that mean? I don't know, but I'm sure you're going to try to live it, because just living in this world, just living as a human, is no longer enough for me. I have, because of the resurrection of Christ, a new existence, a new experience available to me. It's above. I am to seek it, long for it, love it. And just like Cole is loving his time with Gaga, even separated, because his mind is putting himself right in her lap, I am to do that with my Lord. And so the text goes on to say in verse 3 in Colossians, we are dead and your life is hid with Christ in God. How is it possible for us to do this? And the answer is simple. We died. Three times in the Bible the term old man is used. There are also terms like flesh. Those are not the same. The old man was you before you were saved. That was your existence identity. It was all of you, your makeup, before you were saved. You are now a new man. The old man is dead. He was crucified with Christ, Romans 6:6, our meditation verse. You can see it here in verse 9. You've put off the old man with his deeds. He's gone. Okay, the last chapter of his book is written and finished. But the old man, when he was alive, there was this thing called the flesh. The flesh is all of our parts, our members, that are resistant to God. It's our makeup that is in rebellion. And the old man and the flesh work perfectly together. That's all the old man wanted to do, and the flesh enticed him, and he gave in every time. They worked in perfect harmony. Now, the old man's dead. Problem is, the flesh is still there. Those members, those impulses are still there, and my new man doesn't have to give in to them, but he can. And when he does, you know what? He looks just like the old man. Couldn't tell him apart. But the difference is, he has available to him something else, life in the Spirit, you see. He doesn't have to give in to the flesh. He has a new reality, a new existence available to him. Verse 3 said, you died. The old man's gone. Your life is hid with Christ in God. Your experience now ought to be spiritual, heavenly, tapping into the power of God. Romans 8 describes it as life in the Spirit, the law of the Spirit of life. It's described as walking in the Spirit, living in the Spirit, having the fruit of the Spirit. Jude says praying in the Spirit. We have this spiritual part of us now. We don't have to give in to the flesh. We can now live in the Spirit. And so, here we are capable of another reality. But the problem is, point four, we can live as mere humans. And I want to call on you this morning as believers. Don't be merely human. Don't live like the old man yielding to the flesh. You don't have to. That chain has been broken. You do not have to yield to it. You're dead to it. You really are. And when you say to yourself, I can't help it, I give in, I'm not strong enough, I have to sin, I give up. When you say those things, you are denying the resurrection of Jesus Christ and its power, and that's blasphemy. And it's bad theology. Bad theology will always ruin you. You need to have good theology that says, I'm dead to sin. Those terms are used. You take a dead man's corpse and you walk the most lewdly dressed woman in front of it, he won't flinch. He's dead. And that's how you are to the enticements of sin, if you would just believe it and live in the Spirit. And you that are enslaved to sin, shame on you. You're ordinary. And you don't have to be. There's something else available to you. We like going to Disney. Been there a few times. I want you to picture this. Somebody bought the tickets to the theme parks, paid for the hotel. And boy, you pay good money for all that, don't you? And they're sitting in the hotel, and they get up in the morning, and when you turn the TVs on in the hotels in Disney, they default to a channel where you're watching all Disney stuff, where you're watching ads for the theme parks and the water parks and the shopping and the restaurants, you know, and it kind of lets you know what's available to go do. I mean, it's helpful. But picture somebody has paid for all the tickets and all the activities, and they never leave the hotel. They stare at the TV screen going, wow. I think there's a lot of Christians like that. They can talk like they know all about the Christian life, the abundant life. They read the Bible. They go to church. They know all about it. They're watching the ads. But they never live it. They talk like they're living it. They act like they know all about it. But truthfully, they are not living it. They're stuck in the room when their trip to the parks is bought and paid for. And Jesus Christ has bought and paid for your victory over sin, a new life that's thrilling. And you are ordinary. You're sitting in the hotel room. Jesus and Peter are having a conversation. And it went something like this. Peter says, Lord, I'm realizing that you are something really special, like I have never seen before. And I believe you want us to be special too. You call on us to follow you, and I thought that meant just walk around with you. But I know you meant you want us to be like you. Lord, if that's true, I want to be like you right now. And then he said, will you bid me to come out to you on the water? And what did Jesus say? Come. And the second man in human history stepped out and walked on the water. And Peter was no different than you are right now. He was human. But in that moment, he understood he was more than human. And if Peter could walk on water, what can you do? Don't be ordinary.